COVID-19 pandemic has flipped the physician job market from hot to cold. A recent report from physician recruitment firm Merritt Hawkins found that physician recruitment is down and more doctors are looking for work. So how long will this slowdown last? And what do physicians need to know to steer their careers through this unprecedented situation? Medical Economics Editorial Director Chris Mazzolini recently spoke with Travis Singleton, an executive vice president with Merritt Hawkins, to get answers to these and other employment questions.
Travis Singleton, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to ask you first off how the COVID-19 pandemic has been impacting the physician job market.
Well, essentially it's flip-flopped it 60 days. And I don't think that's an understatement to say. There's a lot of overstatements during COVID. I don't know that this is one of them, frankly. And in fact, so we did a survey to final resident students, medical resident students in 2019, and 45% of them were getting over 100 solicitations a year. So to me, it was like they were the number one draft pick a week before the draft. It was the world they were used to. Now we've got words like furlough and layoff. And these are not words that physicians specifically in healthcare are used to hearing. And certainly they're in other industrial sex, and I do hear other people kind of give them the welcome to the club, we're all laid off, right? But I'd like to remind people that not many occupations have over $200,000 of debt just to be able to practice their occupation than to be unemployed. So sometimes it's not apples to apples, but it's as if we went from one position looking at 15 different opportunities to literally the inverse. It's 15 opportunities for every one position. And in that, there's no guarantee that that one opportunity looks the same way it did before we went into COVID. So it's a complete reversal.
What advice do you have for both new graduates, new residents who are coming out and looking for their first career, or maybe a younger physician who's looking for a change? What advice do you have for sort of confronting this job market right now?
Yeah, I think a lot of them, especially early in residency, are having a specialty conversation, right? What does this change the type of medicine I wanted to practice? And what I would do is to get them to think of it not so much in terms of changing specialty, but maybe the setting in which they practice care may change. So look, there's no surprise that those who own and operate private practice in the physician market space, they've been hit hard, right? Most of them have seen a 50% reduction or more in revenue. So we work in conjunction with the Physicians Foundation. And we did a pulse survey through this COVID mess, and early indications are we're going to lose up to 30% of our private practice. And that's a staggering number to lose. Now, that's going to vary by market, obviously, and vary by specialty. But what this has done is essentially poured gas on an already burning consolidation or merger acquisition fire, right? That was going well before COVID. So that in turn pushes employment. This is what I mean by the setting of care they want to practice in. So regardless of who you go work for, if you're looking for a job today, academic medical center, integrated care delivery network, FQHC, it doesn't matter, major group, you have a 95% chance of being employed. And that is going to have real ramifications to the structure of your pay, the structure of your scope of practice, and what technology you use, which we can talk about. Now, there are some positives, I guess, some light at the end of the tunnel when you want to look at what opportunities might there be that weren't there pre-COVID. I think one of the most well-documented cases of this is telemedicine, obviously. Again, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that COVID has maybe given us 4 years of maturity in a market in 4 months. The misnomer in that is what it's done. So that isn't because now we have the technology and we didn't before. It isn't that, okay, now physicians want to use it and patients want to use it to get care. Frankly, that was both there before. And it frankly wasn't even really because healthcare systems didn't trust it or adopt it. We had that before. The change was this pandemic eliminated these archaic regulatory patterns and reimbursement patterns that frankly would have taken years to get rid of. Maybe in today's Congress, decades, depending on how well we get along with anything, but it wasn't going to go anywhere, right? So I think a physician's ability to practice virtually, which are easier from some specialties, easier for some scopes than others, That's going to materially affect how many opportunities they can have during this COVID outbreak. Same could be said about health systems now when you're evaluating different employers. So health systems that had a track record of innovation, that had a firm telehealth foundation as a core delivery of care in place, those have fared much better through COVID and frankly will come out of COVID much faster if you want to look for a more stable employer. There's been great examples of those from provider-led organizations like a Kaiser or a Cleveland Clinic. Not the only examples, but great examples there. So again, I think the setting in which they want to give care is what they need to pay attention to more than just the specialty, if that makes sense.
One of the things that independent physicians often rely on is, you know, if this gets too hard, I can sell to the hospital. What are you guys learning in terms of, has that dried up completely? Is it tougher right now for physicians to work on acquisitions to get acquired by a hospital or private equity or something like that because of the, you know, the financial impact of this pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, everything's tougher, right? I mean, no balance sheet looks particularly healthy right now. So in that sense, yes. But I think it's what it has done has brought folks to the table. Okay. So even if you want to look at what were the barriers before that were causing a group maybe not to want to merge or affiliate or sell out, right? Outside of just the price tag, maybe they wanted blue sky that doesn't exist anymore. Typically, it was around structure. I don't want to give up my structure of pay. I don't want to give up my structure of scope. I don't want to give up my autonomy of the workplace. And often when you've gotten these deals, and we've negotiated thousands of them, it comes down to the compensation structure itself. And what we found is that barrier is removing itself quite expeditiously. Most systems were incrementally changing this as to not have too much change management at once, make sure that they don't affect morale of those providers, to not offset some of those reliant fee-for-service pathways that we have, right? The difference I see now is you have providers, both private and not, that were based on fee-for-service that have seen their productivity, their utilization, their income go to zero, right? Suddenly, they are the ones screaming, something has to change, right? We can't have this same structure. They are the ones coming to the table. So that, in effect, is the gas on the fire when you come to merger acquisition. On top of, look, what is private practice running from in the first place? When you look at compliance, you look at EMR, you look at, look, they're a small business like anything else, right? You have small business costs that are rising. They need help like anyone else, right? You put all those factors together and it is somewhat of a perfect storm.
Let's talk about physician compensation. What have you seen during this pandemic? And it might be a bit too early to tell, but what impacts are we seeing on physician pay, on offers, those kinds of things?
Well, again, look, you've seen utilization and productivity go in the tank, right? So anytime you see that, you see hospitals that are certainly they're not growing. At worst, they're laying off. Most of them are in between. So you're going to see a reduction in recruitment. Therefore, you're going to see a reduction in recruitment incentives. Clearly, you're going to see a reduction in productivity patterns, specifically for those that are relied on elective procedures or fee-for-service. As I mentioned before, if there's anything we didn't need a reminder of, but the pandemic gave us one, is that we are way, for all our talk of quality, for all our talk of restructuring healthcare, we are still way too reliant on fee-for-service pathways. So of course you're gonna see a dip in that, somewhere around 10 to 15% depending on the specialty. Now, what are some factors that could mitigate that? So those specialties that can adapt to telemedicine, that can adapt to virtual health faster, obviously they'll be able to maintain a larger percentage of their practice. Health system or not, private practice or not. Those that are in direct COVID care clearly might actually see a spike in utilization, a spike in productivity, and ultimately a spike in compensation. And even those that have been innovative in being able to adapt their scope to give COVID care. There's been great examples of emergency medicine physicians now managing care teams on floors up into the hospital, working with different leadership structures and technologies that they never worked with before. Even physicians that have gone to care for maybe vulnerable populations like homeless or nursing home or transitions of care. These are innovations that hopefully will pay off. But if you're not in a position to do that, you're going to take a hit. I think the long-standing hit to compensation, I'm not sure if we're going to know the full ramifications of that, maybe even for a year or two.
Let's zoom in on primary care. A lot of our audience are primary care physicians. And I just wanted to talk a little bit specifically about, you know, internal medicine, family practice, on what the job market is like for those specialties. So can you talk a little bit about you know, what the primary care job market looks like now and into the future?
So I think if you just look at the primary care market in general, one thing is we want to remind people of the headlines going into COVID, right? And one thing that we clearly saw in primary care was convenience was king. This convenience medicine, right? We already had a younger, this is pre-COVID, we already had a younger patient population that didn't have a primary care physician per se, right? They had more a collection of urgent care visits and maybe telehealth and those types of things. They were already knocking at the door pushing. Now, COVID exacerbated this. So in 2018, again, in conjunction with the Physicians Foundation, we did a national survey and we found that 18% of total physician population were using telehealth in some form or fashion. Now, in that 18%, it was a little bit misleading because it was usually just a very small sliver of their practice. So they had telehealth, but not much. It wasn't core, right? You fast forward to past April when we did that again. That number jumped up to 50%. Frankly, in some markets, it was as high as 80%. And in that number, it wasn't a sliver of their practice. It was the majority of their practice. So I think in a sense, it's more of the evolution of the primary care role in the market itself. And look, NP and PAs, they play a big part in that, right? The primary care physician, what COVID has done is sort of spurred this innovation to move them more from, say, frontline basic care to more quarterback of the system, right? So now we need to use our non-physician clinicians to not only expand that convenience care, but also to allow that physician to handle the chronic, the complex, and the totality of that care. So to be communicating through the full care team, right? Something we've talked about for a good deal, but have been unable to spur on for all the fee-for-service and things that we talked about before. In this sense, I think COVID has pushed that along. Frankly, one thing, again, to remind folks, non-physician clinicians, specifically NP and PAs, their rise in demand for the past 5 years has been steady. This is not a new spike, right? Arguably, you could even go back closer to 10 years to see the rise. The one thing the U.S. healthcare system does, now you can debate a lot of things about our healthcare system. Many people do. The one thing we could say unequivocally is that we use our non-physician clinicians better or as good as any other industrialized nations out there. We really do. And in fact, I could make the argument that had we not utilized them so well, we would have hit critical mass long ago. So in that case, I see it as is not adversarial. Right? I see it as a collective team environment. When I talk to physicians that might be threatened by that, one, once you show them statistics, they sort of back off that too. Look, utilization will come back, right? And we can talk about it in a minute of what's driving that and why we'll come back, but utilization is going to come back. And it's probably going to come back at the worst time when we're dealing with potentially peak COVID patients in the fall, right? With flu season. Little to nothing happens in the United States healthcare system without a physician approval. Their demand is set in stone. It's going nowhere. There will not be a time in any recent future where we don't need physicians because their role is taken by somebody else. On the flip side of that, those that don't innovate and change to manage more with their non-physician clinicians, I do see them playing a diminishing role in what that new system could be.
Let's talk about that utilization question, because like when you said that, I was thinking the same thing. Where is utilization? It sounds like you're saying it is going to come back, but it might come back in a challenging time. Can you kind of flesh that out a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's Murphy's Law, right? It's always going to come when we can't afford it to. And, you know, look, we look at utilization patterns like everybody else. When you look at what the fall could be, and I stress could be because no one knows. Right? And you look at the areas that we were already strained. And again, our need was ubiquitous, right? Now, of course, you're looking at those specialties, those utilization patterns that were directly affected by COVID. So emergency medicine, pulmonary critical care, infectious disease, parts of primary care. Of course, we saw a huge spike and there's a huge demand in those. I don't know that we see those going away because this is turning into a much more chronic complex issue than a treatable malady and you're out, which is a bit scary for other reasons. One of the more overlooked portions of utilization that we see is anytime that you see economic stress, war, recession, quickly to follow that will be mental health. And we came into this pandemic with a bona fide public healthcare crisis in mental health, not having near enough psychiatrists, really all psychiatric caregivers, but certainly not enough psychiatrists. The other is to remind folks of the headlines going into the pandemic on utilization. The AAMC had just not reverse course, but enhanced their projections to almost 140,000 physicians that were gonna be short by the year 2033. They reversed that or projected that up from 122,000. Well, I mention that because WMC doesn't change those things lightly and it doesn't do it very often. So it showed you our need was ubiquitous. Now, the indirect effects of COVID as you're hitting a vulnerable population, those with high poverty or not access to food or nursing home, those types of things. What those long-term effects on utilization will be, we don't really know. But I see this as probably a stepping off point that we're going to have to look at things differently. We're going to have to attack this differently. And unlike previous markets where we've had not the luxury, but we've looked at this more of, okay, well, let's look at this incrementally. We're going to hit the middle of fall. And we're going to saying, we have peak utilization patterns year over year that are probably 130 to 150% surge. We've got COVID projections that, let's just say they're at where we think they will be, which is worse enough. There is nothing on the table that we won't have to re-examine, including what the physician's role is in this. So all those aging population, baby boomers, lack of social economic investment, poverty areas, the fact that we have just terrible diet and substance abuse issues in the United States, we didn't solve any of those. If anything, we kind of put it in a little corner and forgot about it for a little bit. That's why I think all of us that study this like nerds feel the safest bet is it's coming back. Now, the X factor is how fast and when.
I wanted to go back to something you had mentioned, which is the residency slots in this country and how that hasn't changed for decades. Is there any chance of that, of them expanding the number of slots so that we can have more doctors and try to address some of the physician shortage issues from the bottom end?
Well, if you look at the system in which we grow physicians and its two main components, medical students, residency slots, which you're speaking of, the part that we can affect fairly rapidly with less regulatory environment and less financial investments, more private investment, is medical school. And consequently, we've seen that on an increase of about 35% over the last 15 years. Of increasing medical school enrollment. So they've done their part. Unfortunately, we are creating one of the most highly educated, in debt, out of work populations that we can, right? Because to your point, the funnel they have to go through with residency. What that has done has created a terrible environment for international medical students. Their match rate, sometimes up to 40% of them don't match. A lot of people don't even realize that American medical students, a significant portion of them now are not matching. You even see DO students up above 10%. We have seen ripples in the pond as far as increasing residencies here and there, mostly by private or state-run funding channels. But because of the expense, they've been ripples in the pond, right? Maybe a few hundred over the past 10 years. Estimations of what it would take. So the amount of this is pre-COVID, right? The amount of residency slots it would take to just meet demand at projection at current rate was somewhere around $7 to $8 billion of investment, okay? That was pre-COVID. jury's out on what that's going to look like post-COVID. I don't, you know, you hear that phrase, boy, that's going to take an act of Congress to get done. This quite literally takes an act of Congress to get done. And I don't know how much faith you have in this Congress to get anything done, but agreeing on an issue, then investing in an healthcare market in which they've actively trying to take money out of for the past 15 years. Is there a chance? I guess there's a chance. I don't know that I would bake my mortgage on it. I'll put it that way.
One aspect of the physician shortage that I think is a crucial one right now, especially with COVID, is rural healthcare. These are folks that often can't get to their doctor virtually because of lack of internet infrastructure and all of those things. What do we need to do to get more physicians and other healthcare providers into rural areas? And is there anything, is there any solutions to that, to those challenges?
Yeah, I mean, I think the debate has been solved. Do we have a maldistribution? So one, we don't have enough providers, we don't have enough physicians, and we have a maldistributions of the ones we have. At least we're not having that debate anymore. Crazily enough, we had a debate that for years, right? You know, I don't think it's going to come from the workforce. In other words, I don't know that you're going to find enough FTEs. When you have a ubiquitous need like this that we saw coming into COVID, and then you saw such an extreme case of COVID that exacerbate these channels, and where do you see the headlines now of what it's hitting? It's hitting those underserved. It's hitting those populations where poverty is greatest, those that don't have access to preventative care, those that may have language barriers or transportation barriers or healthy food barriers, all those types of things. Unfortunately, those are the populations that are being decimated most. And I think a lot of people are surprised to find out that these underserved areas, even by federal designation, they're not just in nowhere North Dakota. They're in downtown Detroit. They're in Chicago. They're in highly populated areas, and we still don't have enough. So I think on the one hand, to think you're going to get there through a workforce when you can't invest in what grows them, probably not going to happen that way. I think on the positive side, if you can expose more of them to a true rural rotation and training, to where they see that it's a much fuller scope of care in some cases. You see you have more autonomy in some cases. You see what that lifestyle and quality of life can be. Many of them choose it. When they swore to me in residency that they never would look at it, right? They actually end up working there and liking it. But outside of technology, where you look at virtual care, telehealth, and again, that's why we're so encouraged. Even when you look at Pence's team that they put together and we're looking at early projections of what telehealth will be, no one knows it yet, disclaimer, right? It's not out. But we feel safe to say it's going to be somewhere between 70 to 95% reimbursement of a telehealth visit of what it was for an inpatient or an office patient visit. And that's coming from 30%, right? So this is now a bona fide care pathway. Now it's on us to redesign the care team and get people to go into it. So, and the regulatory environment around the scope they're going to allow is positive. That's going to be a big player in how we get to rural healthcare. I think past that, again, let's look at that population, that highly educated, highly in debt population we create, right? What do we do with them? Anytime you see this mass chaos, you see innovations. And the only state I can think of pre-COVID that was actively trying to change for these medical students that hadn't matched yet was Missouri. And they had it where they were putting them in underserved markets. You had these medical students that had more care direction and education and hands-on training than half the caregivers that were in the market. And we weren't using them, which is insane, right? So I think we have to find a better way to use them even before they get their license to practice medicine. We have got to find a better way to use international medical graduates. Okay, if you're not going to let them practice medicine until they go through a residency program and the J-1 status is not going to grow, there's got to be something they can do and the continuum of care. And the other is we need to start looking at our total physician population almost in terms of productivity versus FTE or full-time equivalents. And what I mean by that is almost any other industrial sect looks at contingent labor and permanent labor, almost like the Amazon model. It's fluid, it's flexible, we change it all the time. Healthcare hasn't quite got to that, right? In the physician side. Nursing side, you could say they're a little bit better. But when you see that the physician's retiring see anywhere between 15 to 20% more patients per day than those coming into the ranks, right? And when you look at, I talked about that market now being 95% employed. So when you look at the employed physician sees about 15%, 15 to 17% less patients or less productive than their practice owner counterpart, right? Those are real numbers, right? So if we start looking at terms like that, then you start looking at rural areas, then you start looking at technology, you're gonna start looking at care teams differently. And you're going to start looking at technology different, which should drive better reimbursement, and it should get rid of these age-old regulatory environments that drive us crazy.
My last question is, we've talked about a lot of different topics about the physician job market. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you think it's important for physicians to keep in mind?
I don't know that it's that we haven't talked about it, but it's more for their own sanity. As I talk to a lot of folks that, again, it's tough for everybody out there. It may be doubly tough for them because this is so new to them. It's going to come back, right? Don't despair. Utilization will come back. Economic recovery might take a little longer in other markets. There's, as we talked about, there's indicators to know who's going to pull out of this a little bit better than the other person or the other employer, but it's going to come back. As I look, you know, any, whether it's war or whether it's this huge disruptions in the marketplace, anytime we go through this, it leads innovation. Painfully, but leads innovation. And as I talk to different healthcare delivery systems of all types, and we're all in some different phase of either augmenting their strategic initiatives, scrapping some, creating new ones, right? We're all learning on the fly here, right? This is a time for fresh eyes at everything. We need to look at service lines differently, leadership structures, communication between specialties, care team design, technology we use, right? Even if it's just looking at your physician engagement and your retention patterns differently, right? This, to me, the groups that are just saying, gosh, I can't wait till it returns back to normal, those are the groups that are gonna be left by the wayside. It's the groups that are leaning into this saying, okay, how do we look differently? How does the physician role practice differently? That to me is the $64,000 question, but not if they're going to be needed and not if they're going to come back. I promise you, utilization will come back.
Travis Singleton, thank you very much for your insights and for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. You can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. And be sure to visit our website at medicaleconomics.com, where you'll find all the latest news about the business of healthcare. We hope you'll listen next month for a new episode of Off the Chart with Medical Economics.